It's kind of hard to deny we're living in an age of, well, engineered compulsion, isn't it? Today, we're doing a deep dive into the blueprint behind modern tech, really exploring the psychology that turns a simple app into something you have to check every day.
Right. And when we talk about habits, we mean things done often without, much conscious thought at all. Just think about your own routine. The stats are kind of wild, right? Like 79% of smartphone owners check their device within 15 minutes of waking up.
15 minutes, that's
It
fast.
is. And get this, a third of Americans admit they'd rather give up sex than lose their cell phones. That's a serious level of compulsion. And it's something designers are actively aiming for.
Wow. Cognitive psychologists call a habit an automatic behavior triggered by situational cues, basically stuff you do without thinking. And the whole point of product design, whether it's like Google or Instagram, is to engineer those cues, to kind of nudge your behavior exactly where they want it.
Precisely. And our mission today is to really dissect the master plan they often use, the hook model. It's this four-phase process companies use to build those automatic behaviors. They're aiming for what the sources call first-to-mind wins.
First to mind wins. What does that mean exactly?
It means when you feel that little twinge of boredom or maybe loneliness, you just automatically open Twitter or Instagram or whatever it is. You don't even type the name into a search bar. It just happens.
Yeah.
That's the hook model succeeding. That's the win.
Okay, got it. And this model has four phases we're going to dig into.
Yep, four sequential phases: trigger, action, variable reward, and investment. But before we jump into the how, the psychology bit, let's maybe talk about the why. The cold, hard business reasons companies are so obsessed with making us creatures of habit.
Makes sense. Why bother?
Well, it pretty much boils down to competitive advantage. Pure and simple. If you can lock in a habit, you massively increase your customer lifetime value, the CLTV.
Right, because if you use it every day, you're just inherently more valuable than someone who logs in like once a month.
Exactly. More usage equals more value. And this habit thing, it also gives companies greater pricing flexibility. Once users form these routines, they become, well, less sensitive to price hikes or switching to paid models.
Oh, yeah, like an example.
Sure. Look at Evernote. Their CEO released this data. They called it the smile graph. It showed that after about 42 months of using it habitually,
Okay.
0.26% of users were suddenly willing to pay for a service they'd always gotten for free. The habit itself made the cost seem reasonable.
Wow. So the habit justifies the price eventually. That's powerful. And I remember reading that habits also just supercharge growth, right? Like exponentially.
They absolutely do. It's all about decreasing the viral cycle time.
Viral cycle time.
Yeah, that's just the time it takes for one user to bring in another user. If the product gets used constantly, maybe multiple times a day, that cycle time shrinks dramatically. And if you cut that time in half, the growth isn't just twice as fast, it curves upwards, exponentially.
Okay, that makes sense. Faster invites, faster growth. And the last business point was about competition. Habits build a kind of wall.
A moat, yeah. The source material mentions something pretty striking. New products often need to be nine times better to break an existing user's habit.
Nine times better. That's huge.
It's a massive hurdle. Think about the QWERTY keyboard. We know there are more efficient layouts, technically superior ones, but the effort, the cognitive cost of ditching the QWERTY habit we all have is just too high. People won't switch. That inertia is the ultimate barrier for competitors.
So true. I'm still using QWERTY. Okay, so how do designers figure out if a behavior is actually likely to become a habit? Is there a sweet spot?
Yeah, they call that the habit zone. For a behavior to really stick and become a default, two things need to be high enough. First is frequency, just how often you do the thing. And second is perceived utility, how useful or rewarding you find it.
Okay, frequency and utility. Can you give examples?
Sure. Think about Google search. Super high frequency, right? We use it constantly. But maybe the perceived utility gain over, say, Bing, once you actually get the search results, it's maybe not that huge for most search
Right, very
engines.
similar results usual.
Exactly. Now contrast that with Amazon. Maybe lower frequency for many people, not multiple times a day, but it's perceived utility, off the charts. It's the everything store. That utility is massive.
Interesting distinction. And this relates to the vitamins versus painkillers idea.
Yeah, exactly. Often these habit-forming products start out as vitamins. They're nice to haves. They appeal to like an emotional need, feeling connected maybe or organized. But once that habit is really locked in and you associate the product with relieving some kind of discomfort, it morphs into a painkiller. It soothes an itch.
So it goes from nice to have to must have. The habit becomes essential.
That's the goal. That transformation is key. And it all starts with phase one, the trigger.
The spark plug.
That's a good way to put it. The trigger is the actuator, the initial cue. The sources used a neat analogy. Habits build on existing needs, kind of like how a tiny piece of grit makes an oyster form a pearl. It needs that starting point.
And these triggers start as external ones first, things outside of us.
Usually, yeah. There are four main types of external triggers. You've got paid triggers, ads, search engine marketing, mostly for getting new users.
Okay.
Then earned triggers, stuff like viral videos, getting press mentions, takes time, relies on PR, kind of unpredictable. You also have relationship triggers, classic word of mouth, referrals. Think about how PayPal originally grew by paying people to refer friends.
Right, the incentive strategy.
But the most crucial one for building repeat engagement, for really cementing the habit, is the owned trigger.
Owned. Meaning the company controls it.
Sort of. It's the real estate the product takes up in your environment because you allowed it. The app icon on your phone's home screen, that push notification that pops up, the email newsletter you signed up for.
So I own the space, but they own the trigger because I gave permission.
Precisely. They exist because you let them, and they allow the company to ping you again and again, pulling you back into the hook cycle.
Okay, but the real goal isn't just those external pings, right?
Hmm.
It's something deeper.
Exactly. The ultimate goal is to move beyond needing that external nudge to the internal trigger. These just pop up in your mind automatically. They get tightly linked with your existing thoughts, your emotions, maybe just your daily routines.
And the research suggests these internal triggers are often negative feelings.
Yeah, it's a bit dark, but very effective. Things like boredom, loneliness, fear, uncertainty, maybe confusion. The product becomes the go-to thing to soothe that slight nagging emotional discomfort, that bitch we mentioned.
Could you give an example of that?
Well, the sources mention a user named Yin who used Instagram constantly. She posted dozens of pictures a day. Why? Mm. She says she felt she needed to grab it before it's gone. The internal trigger wasn't, you know, the joy of sharing photos. It was the fear of losing a special moment forever.
Wow. Fear as the driver. So how do designers actually uncover that core emotional trigger? It's not always obvious.
They often use a technique adapted from the Toyota production system, actually. It's called the five whys method.
Five whys?
Yeah. You just keep asking why about five times to drill down past the surface reason to the root emotion. Let's use Julie, the email user from the source material.
Okay. So Julie checks her email constantly. Why? That's why hashtag one.
Because she wants to see if she has new messages.
Yeah.
Okay. Why hashtag two? Why does she care about new messages?
Because she needs to reply, stay on top of things.
Right. Why hashtag three? Why does she feel the need to reply right away?
Because maybe she doesn't want to fall behind at work or seem out of touch with friends.
Getting closer, why hashtag four? Why does being out of the loop matter so much?
Because she's afraid she might miss something important. An opportunity or critical info or just feel left out.
Bingo. And why hashtag five? What's that underlying feeling? It's often uncertainty. Or anxiety, that fear of being out of the loop, that's the deep negative internal trigger the email app scratches.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So once that trigger fires, internal or external, we hit phase two, action.
Right, and the key principle here is simplicity. The action has to be easier than thinking about it. Remember, habits bypass conscious thought. To understand this, designers often use the FOG behavior model. Heard of it?
Vaguely. B equals M at.
That's the one. Behavior B happens when motivation M, ability A, and a trigger T all occur at the same time, and strongly enough, B mat.
Okay. Motivation, ability, trigger.
Motivation is your desire, the energy for the action. FOG breaks it down into three core motivators. Seeking, pleasure, avoiding pain.
Makes sense.
Seeking hope, avoiding fear.
Like those political ads.
Exactly. And seeking social acceptance, avoiding rejection. You see that everywhere in advertising, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you're saying designers focus less on boosting motivation.
Generally, yes. Trying to fundamentally increase someone's motivation is hard. It's expensive. It's much easier and more effective to increase their ability to make the action simpler. Evan Williams, the Twitter co-founder, basically said, innovation is just identifying a human desire and then relentlessly taking out steps.
Taking out steps. Okay.
Yeah.
How do they measure simplicity?
They look at six main factors. How much time does it take? How much money? How much physical effort? How many brain cycles, like cognitive load?
Okay.
Is there social deviance involved? Will doing this make me look weird?
Mm-hmm.
And is it non-routine? Does it disrupt my existing flow too much? The goal is to minimize all of these.
And you see this everywhere online. Google's super simple homepage, the predictive search, that cuts down time and brain cycles.
Totally. Or Facebook login eliminates all those tedious registration fields. That's huge for ability.
Yeah.
Even small things like the iPhone letting you swipe up the camera from the lock screen. It just removes steps, removes friction, increases ability.
Right. And they also use psychological shortcuts, heuristics, to make things feel easier.
Oh, yeah. These mental shortcuts or cognitive biases are powerful ways to boost perceived ability or motivation.
It's like the scarcity effect. That one's common.
Super common. The basic idea. We value things more if they seem scarce. Remember that study with the cookie jars?
Vaguely.
People rated cookies taken from a nearly empty jar as tasting better and being more valuable than the exact same cookies from a full jar. Scarcity implies value. Amazon nails this with those only three left in stock warnings. It creates urgency, makes you feel the action of buying is more valuable right now.
Sneaky. What about the endowed progress effect?
Ah, that's a good one. It's about making people feel like they've already made progress towards a goal, which makes them more motivated to finish, like giving someone a coffee shop loyalty card that already has a couple of stamps on it versus a completely blank one.
Oh, right. They're more likely to complete the card if it looks like they've already started.
Way more likely. The study showed a 76% faster completion rate, and LinkedIn does this masterfully. When you sign up, your profile completion bar often starts already partway filled, maybe 50%.
Yeah, I've seen that.
That little boost makes you think, oh, I'm already halfway there. And it leverages that bias to get you to invest more effort right away. It feels easier to finish.
That progress bar is a perfect segue into phase three, variable reward. You mentioned earlier, it's not just any reward, it has to be variable. Why is that so important?
Because our brains are wired for anticipation, not just the reward itself. Predictability is boring. When you introduce variability, like pulling a slot machine lever where you might win, your brain's dopamine system goes into overdrive. It hijacks the judgment centers and cranks up the craving centers.
So the not knowing is what hooks us.
Absolutely. Once you know exactly what's going to happen, your interest drops off a cliff. Variability keeps you coming back. And there are three main types of these variable rewards.
Okay, what are they?
First, rewards of the tribe. These tap into our deep-seated need for social connection, acceptance, status, feeling like we belong.
So likes, comments, shares on social media.
Exactly. That's the engine. Or think about sites like Stack Overflow for programmers. The points and badges aren't really about money. They're about status and respect within that community. You keep contributing to maintain or increase that tribal standing.
Okay. Rewards of the tribe. What's next?
Rewards of the hunt. This is about pursuing resources, information, or material possessions. It connects back to our evolutionary past, searching for food and vital info.
Like the slot machine again.
The purest example, yeah. But online, it's the endless, unpredictable scroll of your Twitter feed. You're hunting for that interesting tweet, that useful link. Or how Pinterest often cuts off images at the bottom of the screen. It creates an information gap, makes you curious, compels you to scroll down your hunting for the rest of the picture.
Ah, that infinite scroll is definitely a hunt. Okay, tribe, hunt. What's the third?
Rewards of the self. These are about intrinsic motivation, feeling mastery, competence, achieving completion. It's a more personal sense of satisfaction.
Like beating a level in a video game.
Perfect example. Or achieving inbox zero in an email app like Mailbox used to offer. That feeling of completion is the reward. Codecademy uses this too, with progress bars and badges for learning to code. But here's a crucial point. The reward must fit the user's internal trigger. If people are seeking social validation, offering them money instead won't work. The reward has to scratch the right itch.
Right. And what about autonomy? Can companies overdo it with these rewards and make it feel manipulative?
Definitely. If users feel coerced or tricked, it triggers something called reactance. It's that impulse to rebel when you feel your freedom is being threatened. Quora learned this the hard way. They automatically opted users into a feature showing what questions they'd viewed. Even though views could be seen as a social reward, users felt exposed and controlled, and they pushed back hard.
So you can't just force rewards on people. You have to make it feel natural, like something they want to engage with.
Exactly. It should leverage existing desires or social behaviors, not feel like a chore the company assigned you. And one more thing about rewards. Finite versus infinite variability. Well, experiences with finite variability, like watching a TV series that ends, or playing a game like Farmville where the loops become predictable, eventually lose their pull. The variability runs out.
Oh, okay. You know what's coming.
Right. To keep the habit loop going long term, you ideally need infinite variability. That's the magic of user-generated content platforms. Think Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, even massive games like World of Warcraft. The content, the interactions, the rewards are always changing because the users are constantly feeding the system. It never gets old in the same way.
That makes sense. Infinite content, infinite variability, potentially infinite habit. Which brings us finally to phase four, investment. This sounds a bit different.
It is. Investment is where the user actually does a bit of work. They put something of value into this system. It could be time, data, effort, social capital, maybe even money.
Wait, so this phase actually increases friction. Doesn't that go against the make it easy principle from the action phase?
It seems counterintuitive, yeah. But the purpose of investment isn't immediate gratification like the reward phase. It's about setting up future rewards and, more importantly, fundamentally changing the user's attitude and perception of the product. This is what really locks the habit in and moves the product up, that perceived utility axis we talked about, planting it firmly in the habit zone.
How does putting in work change my attitude?
It taps into some really deep psychology. One big one is the IKEA effect.
Yeah, I think I know this one.
Eh.
We value stuff more if we build it ourselves.
Exactly. We irrationally overvalue things we've invested our own labor in, even if it's just assembling flat pack furniture. That effort creates attachment. Mm. It also ties into our need for consistency. We strive to be consistent with our past actions and statements.
Okay, how does that apply?
Remember the study about lawn signs? People who first agreed to put a tiny, unobtrusive sign in their yard were way more likely later to agree to a huge, ugly billboard. They wanted to remain consistent with their initial small commitment. Small investments in an app can lead to bigger ones later because we want our actions to align.
And then there's cognitive dissonance, avoiding that uncomfortable feeling when our beliefs and actions don't match up.
Precisely. We hate feeling like we made a bad choice or wasted our effort. So we actually change our preferences to justify our past actions. It's the fox deciding the grapes he couldn't reach must have been sour anyway.
Right. Gotta make sense in our heads.
Yeah. Or think about players in games like Mafia Wars back in the day who spent real money on virtual items. To reduce the dissonance of spending money on something intangible, they'd rationalize it. Well, only an idiot would spend $20 if this wasn't actually valuable. They convince themselves the investment was worthwhile, which increases the perceived value and makes them more likely to keep playing and spending.
So the investment makes us like the product more just to justify the effort we put in.
That's a huge part of it. And that investment creates stored value in the product, which acts like switching costs, making it harder to leave. This stored value generally comes in two forms.
Okay, what are they?
First is content, all the stuff you put into the system. Your playlists on Spotify, your photos and timeline on Facebook, your documents in Google Drive. The service becomes a repository for your digital life.
Right. Leaving means losing all that history.
Exactly. And the second is data. This can be stuff you actively provide, like building out your resume on LinkedIn, or data collected passively, like your purchase history on Amazon or your fitness stats. The more data and content you store, the more tailored and valuable the service becomes to you, and the bigger the pain to start over somewhere else.
Wow. So that completes the loop. Trigger fires. Easy action leads to a variable reward, which prompts an investment, loading the next trigger and storing value.
That's the hook model cycle. Trigger, action, variable reward, investment, over and over. And with today's tech, constant connectivity, huge data processing, incredible speed, this cycle can run incredibly fast and effectively.
It really is a powerful system. The sources called this ability to engineer behavior a kind of superpower.
Yeah, and like any superpower, it can be used for good, you know? Building healthy habits, improving productivity, strengthening relationships, or it can be used to create mindless addiction and compulsion.
Which leads to a really interesting final thought. The sources mentioned that old habits are notoriously hard to break. They cited the LIFO principle, last in, first out.
Right, meaning new behaviors, new habits are often the first to go when we're stressed or circumstances change. They're layered on top of older, more deeply ingrained neural pathways.
So if those old pathways, like the reflex to check email when bored, are still etched in our brains, even if we adopt a new app habit for a while, what happens long term?
That really leaves us, and you, the listener, with something to think about, doesn't it? As you look at the habits in your own life, consider this. What level of consistent, high-perceived utility and deep, meaningful investment is actually required for a new product or behavior to truly overwrite or displace an old, competing habit?
Instead of just creating another habit layered on top, one that might fade away easily.
Exactly. Can these new hooks permanently rewire us, or are they just temporary tenants in our minds?
That is definitely something worth mulling over the next time your thumb just starts scrolling on its own. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.